Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. Now, my guest today is Anil Sebastian, the artist, musician, and creative director of specialist sonic branding agency, DLNDD. As co-founder of the world-leading alternative choir, London Contemporary Voices, Anil has fostered a creative safe space for transgender and gender non-conforming singers to use their voices and spread the joy of music. And it's the act of spreading joy that drives Anil in their work and life, inspired by their own quote for today, joy is an act of resistance. From resisting the imposter syndrome they say they live with each day to the challenges that come with their own identity as mixed race, queer and non-binary, Anil has turned many of life's barriers into a joyous and completely unique body of work, which sees them recognized as one of the most exciting artists in the UK today. Anil, welcome to Changemakers.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm telling you, what a great half hour we've got ahead with your story. Now, listen, let's start with your quote for life, because I feel like it's a motif for what might happen next. Joy is an act of resistance. Tell us a little bit more about that brilliant sounding quote.
Yeah, joy is an act of resistance. I think it is a reminder that celebration and joy and can in a way be an act of resistance in a world where sometimes marginalized groups particularly are portrayed in a particular way, or their narrative is kind of told from an outside perspective rather than from within. And so for me, it's kind of a way of reclaiming that a little bit. And I'm always reminded of, if ever I'm commissioned to create a piece of work, often if it's about a challenging situation or a challenge that a particular marginalized group is facing or something like that, often there's this kind of like voice in my head that's telling me I need to write something really dramatic and sad and capture all of that pain. But actually, a lot of the time, people's instinct in those situations is celebration and joy, and that can sometimes be the most cathartic thing, actually. And it's a sort of funny thing, you know.
There's a lovely balance between joy and resistance, isn't there, in terms of the, I guess, in terms of, like, you know, a really lovely poetry. And I suppose the voice is something that is important to you in terms of both finding your voice, expressing your voice, but using it musically as well, as a co-founder of London Contemporary Voices. Tell us a little bit about that and why it means so much to you.
I think for me, we all have a voice. It's very unique and it's very personal. It's extremely personal, but it is our primary form of expression. It's where we go to express ourselves. And it's very likely, almost certain, that singing and vocalization preceded language, you know. Mm. And in that sense, I think there's something extremely primal about singing and music. And I think the other thing that's really fascinating from a neurological perspective is that it's multi-sited within the brain. So there are many different brain areas kind of coming to life when we use our voices and sing. And when you add in the social aspect of singing in a group, then you also have empathy and coordination, as well as fine motor behavior.
And rhythm, I suppose.
Rhythm,
as well.
Language, it's just incredible. And singers generally have better connections between those different areas than people who don't sing so much. And so for me, I think we're taught as a society, we kind of unlearn singing. Rather than something that we need to sort of learn how to do, I think it's more that
I suppose in terms of the question, why do we unlearn singing? But frame that within the context of what London Contemporary Voices aspires to do.
Yeah, sure. So I think for me, I came into running a choir by accident. This was founded because my friend Imogen Heap, who I was once playing guitar for, asked me if I would perform at her Royal Albert Hall show 10 years ago. And I said I wanted to go as an audience member. And then she said, actually, could you sing in the choir? And I said, yeah, sure, I can sing. I'll sing in the choir. And it turned out that there wasn't one yet. And she wanted me to set that up. So myself and Didier Rochard founded London Contemporary Voices. And so from the very beginning, it was something that I came into as an outsider. It was something that I came into without any real experience of running a choir or what that should be. But with a deep love for singing and as a singer. So it became something of an experiment. And I think where I began, we had the philosophy very much of bringing together people who would not normally sing together, but bringing together people with exceptional voices and creating this group that could include gospel singers or jazz singers, as well as, you know, the country's best choristers and opera singers. And lots of these voice types, we're told, should not be put together. And, you know, that a choral...
Because I love the potential tension between describing yourselves as a non-conforming choir, because I suppose in the kind of popular mindset, you always think about a choir as something which is all about conforming. That very word feels very loaded when it comes to the idea of, you know, conforming, being well-behaved. Were you very aware of that in your mind when you thought about the language you would use to choose in terms of what kind of group are we? What are we as a collection?
Yeah, I think I've experienced a lot of kind of, what's the word? Gatekeeping, exclusion throughout my life. And I wanted to create something where there would be a sense of community, first and foremost, and that the voice of the group, the sound of the group, would come from that connection that people have with each other. And I think that blend and that kind of combination can develop over time. But I think for me, coming back to the idea of nonconformity, I think sometimes people associate that with kind of disruption or chaos or disorder. But for me, it's quite the opposite. It's founded on sort of love and respect and community. And the idea is going on a journey together as a group, rather than conforming to a very preset idea of what singing is, what it does for us, what it should sound like, and who should be doing it.
But I always think about it is that, and I just think about this in researching today's story, was that, you know, I mean, choirs by their nature are very gendered institutions, aren't they? I mean, you know, you get a boys' choir or a girls' choir. I mean, that's kind of what, you know, the popular conception of a choir is. But it feels to me like quite often in your story, you're taking hold of words, ideas, themes that actually you can bring a new expression, a new identity to. Is that a fair take, that actually you need to get hold of things that maybe you felt not for me a few years before, or maybe today you think, actually, I have every right to be here?
Yeah, I think that resonates very strongly with me, actually. And I think it's about, again, it's this idea of reclaiming something for yourself. But I think also it's about creating the world that you didn't have growing up. So part of it has been trying to create something and trying to grow something that I feel is needed for some people. From London Contemporary Voices, then what happened was, as I sort of came to realise that I was not male or female, or, you know, I'm transgender, non-binary. And as I started to realise this and go on that journey, which is I'm still relatively new to, we discovered that actually it was not somewhere that people like us could really exist very easily because of this nature. And I think, you know, being booked as a singer, I've done so much session singing in my life and working with some really incredible people, but often with this kind of weight of, you must be this, you must be a male singer or a female singer, you cannot be something in between. And actually, my own actual singing voice is one that people really struggle to put a gender to, interestingly. And that's something that's always been the case since I was very young. But growing up, I forced it into a form that was acceptable. So often, you know, my voice is on so many things and I've sung with so many people, but you wouldn't recognize it as me because it's me being the very male version of myself.
Right. Well, listen, I mean, I want to get onto the non-binary journey momentarily, but you mentioned growing up, you mentioned sort of your childhood. And actually I read here that we went through some really tough times as a family and music was a kind of release. It feels like music has been this sort of like fellow traveler in your journey, Anil, from the very earliest of days. Tell us a little bit about that early chapter in your life.
Oh gosh, there's so much to say. I think
we've got time.
I think it's there were so many things crashing together all at once. Right from the get-go, I am mixed race. My father was born in Malaysia and his parents were born in Sri Lanka. My mum was German. She was born in Nazi Germany, you know, during the Second World War. So I think the kind of combination of those two cultures coming together, my dad being Hindu, my mum being Catholic, me growing up with those two very different belief systems, but then at the same time discovering my queerness within myself, it was, on the positive side, a wonderful, inspiring, quite free place in terms of musical exploration. I felt like I could do or be anything in music within my four walls. But there was a huge expectation of who I should be in terms of work and life. And yeah.
But did that background encourage you, liberate you to explore the difference in yourself or not, I guess? And so I'm just thinking about in terms of everybody's sort of like, everybody's journey through life to some degree or not is an exploration about what it means to be the person that they are. In terms of your own, you know, that very unique experience of a mum, of a dad, of an upbringing where, you know, you were asking lots of questions, I guess. I mean, I'm just trying to get a sense of how that shaped the Anil that you've become today.
I think I was always quite odd in a good way in my own little world, exploring things, chopping up cassette tapes and playing on the musical instruments that were in our house. And I think that the family dynamic was complex. We had a lot of challenges, let's say, and it was tough. Home life was tough. We didn't have much money. So I went within myself a lot. And I think also I desperately wanted to fit in, like any kid does. I wanted to fit in. I wanted to belong. School was tough. It wasn't the greatest school in the world. I think it's a lot better now, but at the time it was awful. The experience was really difficult. I felt continuously confronted with my identity. I didn't fit in with the Asian kids. I didn't fit in with the other white kids. I was always in between. So I wasn't brown, I wasn't white enough, I wasn't queer enough, I wasn't man enough or woman enough.
Did you want to fit in? I was reading here that you said, you know, I have major imposter syndrome in virtually everything I do. Tell us a little bit about that.
It's getting better. It is getting better. It's improving. But I think that's it, because you don't feel like you fit in. And actually, most people, that's exactly what they want. That's what I wanted. I don't anymore. Now I think I embrace those differences in myself, because actually it's been the catalyst to most of the good things that have happened to me.
Do you think, in a funny kind of way, that to fit in, you've got to have the confidence to stand out?
Yes. Yes, exactly. And I think, you know, it's like you're trying to mold yourself into something that where you just naturally do not fit. And yes, you can act a certain way into it. And, you know, you can to a degree fake it until you make it. But ultimately, when you're not being authentic, then you develop this sense of I'm not being myself. And the imposter syndrome for me very much stems from the realization, I think, you know, I'm of my gender identity, you know, that actually, of course, I was going to feel like an imposter, because I am constantly acting as though I am something that I'm not.
On that point about gender identity, was there a moment where, you know, was there a moment of consciousness, I guess, in terms of how you were and the experience you were going through, and the thought of this is how I want to be, this is where I want to go?
Yeah, it was actually really quite scary. And I think that's why the joy thing is so important to me. The joy is as an act of resistance, because at the beginning of that journey, it was some days incredible and euphoric to kind of feel that and to be like, gosh, this now makes sense. But on other days, absolutely debilitating, because it's scary, because again, it confronts you with this idea of like, oh my goodness, if I'm only discovering about this about myself now, then what else is there that I don't know about myself? And I thought I knew myself so well. But I think for me, it's partly to do with coming out in the first place as queer was not easy. It went against everything that I had grown up believing and being taught. So I didn't fit in from that perspective. But then also, I was on a journey of recovering as a survivor of abuse, basically. And part of that journey was the realization, because I think I thought so much was to do with that. I thought, well, of course I don't feel in my body, or I feel sort of sometimes dissociated. Of course I would, because of what happened back then. And you know, I've experienced all sorts of things that are very traumatic in terms of abuse.
What were, if you don't mind me asking, what were the questions that abuse provoked in you?
Yeah, I think there was, as dramatic as this sounds, I wrote down the other day, for so long, my body has been a cancer of my mind. That's how it's felt. It's felt like that I am just a brain in the head, and that the rest of me has kind of some weird thing that kind of has grown out of my mind and is separate to it.
Was it disassociated?
Yeah, completely. Yeah. And I remember even the only time I really felt fully in my body was singing. I felt that was how how I felt all in one place together. Mm-hmm. So that's again why singing is so important to me.
And was it singing songs where the narrative mattered, or was it just the sound and the rhythm and the, you know, I guess the spectacle of music?
It's the guts of music.
The
guts of it. It's the actual physical vibration of it. Mm. You know, it really is. And I think the more I've understood as I've got older about how trauma affects the brain, particularly in the work that I've been doing with people with advanced dementias, with living words, or some of the commissions that I've done, and the work I've been doing with DLMDD, interestingly enough, there is a connection with all of it to do with how our brains process emotions, how we experience the world, but also how we experience the world when we have particular brain injuries or trauma, and how that can change how our brains connect. But the wonderful thing about singing is it's sort of a little bit like LSD or something, because it does, like I said earlier, from a neurological perspective, it connects parts of the brain. It works across many different,
presumably takes you to another place.
It takes you to another place, and it has that transformative effect. And it's certainly been one of the key ways in which I've processed my trauma. And it's a great feeling to be here on the other side of it and to be able to share that.
Now, I interviewed Joseph Galliano, who you may know is the museum founder of Queer Britain. And he was talking to me about language and about the reappropriation of the word queer, that actually had gone from being a very negative thing in his early life to being something that he felt just said it in terms of how he felt about life and these sorts of things. Now, tell us a little bit about, from your perspective, Anil, in terms of that word, in terms, because it's something you've mentioned, that also you've suggested Pose as the Netflix choice, which you've described as pure queer excellence. That word matters, doesn't it, in terms of something to feel good about?
It does. I think, again, it comes down to reclaiming of things, you know, reclaiming joy, and actually reclaiming words like joy, queer, are important, putting them together, queer joy, just in the same way that for people of colour, reclaiming certain words has been really important. I think what it's about is that experience of that word being used as a weapon against you, your existence being weaponized against you, your story and narrative being told from the outside, you are this and you are bad, you don't belong, you're a freak, whatever it might be, the associations. And also, of course, more than that, the actual violence towards transgender people and queer people. And so, in a way, reclaiming that word is immensely powerful and liberating, because what power does that really leave someone with? You see it as an insult with you and you just say, yeah, I am, and I'm great.
Well, and I think that's wonderful. And I think it's, and you know something, and I think it speaks to I think it speaks to confidence. I think it speaks to personality, but it also speaks to ambition, because it strikes me that actually, you know, I was looking at some of the bands you've worked with. I mean, everything from U2 to then Harry Potter and the movies, is that this is a mainstreaming of a debate that quite often is carried out in niche sort of publications. It strikes me that actually you are on a stage and you have a voice that you want to be heard. How important is that to you?
Immensely important. And it's not about me, actually. That's the interesting thing for me. I know it sounds very like, what's the word, you know, pious or whatever, but I am genuinely doing this for my community as much as I am doing it for myself.
Right.
And for me, the reality of my life is that if I walk down the street where I live here, if I just do that right now, I receive abuse just for being me. Yeah. I'm not doing anything. I treat people with respect. You can probably get a sense that I'm quite nice, I think. But
easy so. Yeah.
but for some reason, my existence upsets quite a lot of people.
So you've got a microphone. You're in the middle of an interview. This is a lot of people will listen to this. What do you want them to hear? What's the message from you?
I think the message from me is I want to normalize changing of our minds about lots of things, about people. I want us to understand that so many things have been put into a binary system. You know, we live in a very good versus evil universe. There's that. There's the moral kind of binary of like, it's good or it's bad, or it's right or it's wrong, or black, white, you know, man, woman. There are so many of these binaries. And it's not to say that the extremes of those things don't exist, but there is something in the middle. There is a spectrum within the middle. And it's not anything to be afraid of. It doesn't invalidate you. You know, if you are a cisgendered man, there are as many ways to be a man as there are men, just in the same way that there are as many ways to be non-binary as there are non-binary people, and
but in terms of, I mean, you know, I would say, you know, we've not met before, but you come across as a wonderful person to interview. There's a great sort of energy and joy. So the question I was going to ask is that, well, how do you, I mean, are you positive or pessimistic about these set of circumstances? It strikes me that you do maintain a positive disposition despite some pretty terrible challenge in your life. And as you've said, from abuse on the street to abuse personally, what is the superpower? What is the sort of the energy that fuels that positivity in your life, Anil, do you think?
I think for me, it's, the word that comes to mind is love, I think. And actually, weirdly, I would describe myself, I think, as an optimistic nihilist, probably. I kind of think we're doomed.
An entirely new series now. Optimistic nihilist, I've met.
But for me, that's wonderfully liberating. And I think for me, the meaning in life has come for me at that point of like, oh my gosh, what is it all for? What are we doing it all for? What's underneath it all? We don't know. We've got no bloody idea. No one does, if they're honest. And that's wonderfully liberating. And for me, that's where the optimism is. It sits actually in that kind void, because
nobody has the answers.
There
is no destination in this. Yeah. I mean, and you know, I mean, to the point about your work, I mean, we talked about movies and music, but I mean, you appointment as creative director of DLMDD. Congratulations on the Creative Moment Awards for your campaign with Singapore Airlines. Tell us a little bit about that part of the day job, I guess.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. I really fell off my chair when they kind of asked me to join and to come and be part of it. I guess I just didn't ever think that someone like me had a place somewhere like that. So it was sort of strange. I was like, are you sure? Yeah, everything okay? You kind of, you're drinking enough water? It's been incredible. And the more I'm there, the more I realize why they asked me. And I kind of, the more I understand that. And I think for me, it's been a wonderful opportunity to bring what I've learned and what I am continuing to learn about that kind of science art binary, which is changing. It's such an interesting time in both science and art that they are there is an a growing intersection between them. And, you know, you look at works, work of people like Neri Oxman. She's an academic at MIT, and, you know, her work covers that intersection between science and art, and actually gets displayed in MoMA. But at the same time, there are papers and journals being written about it. And I think a lot of that categorization perhaps stems from a little bit of a Victorian obsession with categorization. And I think at this moment in music, we are sitting at this intersection again with technology and with how we use technology, how music affects our brains and our behaviours.
Well, I was going to ask, or make the observation that science and art are, you know, forms of communication in their own right, aren't they? They're an attempt to explain the world in, you know, whether it's from a scientific perspective like physics, or an artistic perspective, you know, or a creative perspective. But they are almost like languages, aren't they, in terms of their ability to help us understand the world.
Yes, they are. And it reminds me of, I was, as part of my work at DLMDD, we have an interview series called DLMDD Meets, and I was interviewing probably the person I have learned the most from in music, Guy Sigsworth, the producer. And he was talking about sometimes music being like a foreign language, and how the most wonderful things happen when you can tell that there is a hidden logic in something. You know that there is a logic and a structure there, but you don't know what it is. And often that's our experience when we hear music, or when we experience incredible art, or when we become drawn to something in science. There's some sort of structure, or there's some logic or a language, but it's alien to us. And that's where we find beauty, I think, in that moment of intersection. That's what excites me.
I suppose those brief moments of understanding the rhythm of change, and that actually, I mean, you've talked about normalizing changing your mind. I mean, that's what the great scientists have done throughout time, isn't it? Is that changing minds is actually a big part of how we make progress.
Absolutely. I mean, and you look at things like duality, the notion of duality, and you have concepts in physics like wave-particle duality. Something can be both a wave and a particle at the same time. Well, why then can it not be the case that somebody can be both male and female and neither at the same time, you know? or both Sri Lankan and German and neither, and English and all of that, but none of that. You know, there's so many ways that matter can exist. There are so many ways that we can exist.
I guess our imagination can exist in terms of, you know, I always love interviews where I just think, I'm only just getting started, and I look at the clock and I'm running out of time. Tell me about butterflies, the butterfly effect. I know that's a big inspiration for you in life.
Yeah, gosh, yes, it is. I did say that.
One small interaction opening up a world of possibilities in different directions. Let's finish on the butterfly effect.
Yeah, chaos theory, I suppose. I actually have a tattoo which is symbolizes that. I find chaos and order and the butterfly effect so fascinating. I remember reading Chaos by James Gleick when I was a teenager, and just finding it incredibly inspiring for that reason, for that kind of moment where something can tip into that incredible, beautiful growth that we see, and how that can be so transformative in so many ways, both in the physical world, but in music and in our journeys in life, that we can, you know, one small moment, one small interaction that you have with somebody can set off a complete revolution in your own being. We live with that possibility being open to us, then changing our mind doesn't just become something that we normalize, it becomes something really strange not to do, you know?
What a wonderful place to leave it. Anil Sebastian, thank you so much for joining me on Changemakers.
Thank you. It's been wonderful to talk to you.
Changemakers is brought to you by the campaign's firm Seven Hills, and presented by me, Michael Heyman. Pure Being is the name of our soundtrack, and it's written and performed by the brilliant BT Wolf. To find out more, head over to changemakers.works, and if you like what you hear, why not give us a rating? Just be